Hey, everybody. Welcome to Brandon Knows Nothing, the podcast where I interview people and I learn about their careers and a bunch of random stuff. I've always wondered about certain fields of study and work and such. This episode is really fun. I interviewed J.L. Colvin, who's a New York comedian and he's still a practicing lawyer, but he used to do a lot more active things in law before he became a full-time comedian. And I've always known about his law background. He used to be part of a comedy group that was full of lawyers that did stand-up comedy. And he talks about it regularly on his Righteous Prick podcast, which I definitely encourage you guys to download. It's on all the same platforms that Brandon Knows Nothing's on, Stitcher, Podomatic, iTunes, and everything. So definitely check out his show. But before you do that, just make sure you rate 5 stars and subscribe to Brandon Knows Nothing. Those numbers are really going up, and I'm really appreciating everyone who's listening. But if you could just make sure you're leaving a review, let me know that you're listening, because those help us pull up in the rankings on iTunes, Stitcher, Podomatic, Google Play, all that stuff. Thank you for everyone who's tweeting positive feedback about it. I got a lot of positive feedback for the past 2 shows with Tiffany from Giphy and Alex from the V-Spot, which he's been very accommodating with letting me host the new weekly stand-up show there with my Grits Comedy Sketch Group. So every Tuesday night, we're at the V-Spot, 12 St. Mark's Place, 7 p.m. Come check me out with a few of my comedian buddies. We're doing trying out new bits, working on sets for other shows and stuff. It's a lot of fun. We got some great comedians every week. So definitely, if you're in the city, and check that out. I'm sure I'm going to have JL on sometime soon as well. And speaking of shows, let me throw a few dates at you guys while I have you. On Thursday, May 26th, I have another Brandon Knows Nothing showcase at Rockaway Brewing Company. It's in Long Island City, 46-01 5th Street. It's right off the Vernon Boulevard, stop on the 7 train. It's one stop off the 7 from Manhattan. So it's not that far. It's going to be free comedy upstairs. They have a lot of dope beers, very strong beers. So if you like to get drunk for cheap, they definitely can help you out there. It's a cool spot. And it's a bit unusual because we don't have a microphone. So it's kind of like spoken word, but with comedy. It's a lot of fun. It's my second show there. So if I can get as many people as possible to come out and support, we can make this a monthly thing. I'm probably going to switch up the structure. So the first 2 months will be stand-up. The next 2 months will probably be storytelling. Then the next 2 months after that, hopefully we'll do like a variety show with like music and art stuff. That'd be dope. So, yeah, May 26th, Thursday, come check that out. It's at 7 p.m. All my shows are early, man. So come out, support, laugh, get some drinks, and then go about the rest of your evening. Another date is Knocking Boots on June 1st. That's a Wednesday. It's 284 Fifth Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. I believe the show starts at 8 p.m. My friend Christian Polanco, he runs this dope show, and I'm going to be doing that. And then later that night, if you don't feel like going to Brooklyn, I'm going to be at Gandhi Is That You, which is in the Lower East Side, ran by Brendan Fitzgibbons and Lance Weiss, 129 Orchard Street. That's at 9 p.m., and that's a show that's been long running in the New York scene, and really excited to be back on that. Those are a few dates, and I also have dates for upcoming Comedy Outliers show for my birthday event, which I'm very excited about. So be on the lookout for that, guys. But in the meantime, let's get to this episode. Like I said, I have J.L. Colvin, who I'm a big fan of, his comedy. He's very dry and sarcastic, very physically imposing guy, which I think it's weird to see him perform on stage because you see people kind of get defensive because they're like, this is a giant man. But then, you understand his sense of humor and he becomes less intimidating. He's really a really nice guy. He's just extremely sarcastic. But I've done a lot of his videos, and I always appreciate having good conversations with him about film and comedy and stuff. And this one was a lot of fun. I wanted to get him on to talk about his past in the law field and what that was like. Because I always wanted to be in law. For people that don't know, I used to do mock trial in high school, and I was very passionate about potentially being a criminal lawyer. I thought being in the courtroom and just pontificating would be a dream come true. until I got to college and started learning more and more about the LSAT and law school and realized, oh, yeah, I'm a selective learner. I would never do well by the end of my first year in law school. I'd probably end up dropping out just because I couldn't absorb like tax law and torts and all that shit. It would just be too much. So I think I said that right. Torts? I don't know. See what I mean? I don't even know the different types of law. All I know is criminal and tax. That's it. Bankruptcy, things like that. I don't know. But this is a really interesting conversation with JL. He talks about law school. He talks about being assistant DA. He talks about how he tried to balance that with comedy and dealing with depression in law school. It is a really awesome episode. I hope you guys enjoy it. And if you enjoy JL, please make sure you check out his podcast, Righteous Prick Podcast, on iTunes, Stitcher, Podomatic. And then also he's recording his next album on June 24th at the Standing Room in Long Island City, which is really blowing up for comedy. So definitely make sure you're if you're around, check out JL's special taping. You can get the dates and more information about purchasing tickets at jlcomedy.com. And without further ado, here's my interview with JL. Hope you guys enjoy. And remember, rate 5 stars and subscribe. I love you. Peace. I'm not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. I'ma get a scholarship to King's College. I probably shouldn't brag, but dag, I'm amazed and astonished. The problem is a lot of... Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening. This is Brandon Knows Nothing with my guest, JL Colvin.
Where's Mike Brown? I thought he was going to be here. What the fuck is this? Where's the star power?
This is the podcast where I ask people.
What is this, the Scottie Pippen podcast? Come on, man.
Oh, shit.
I'm kidding.
No, you're not. It's all right.
All right. Come on, Jazzy Jeff. Let's go.
Jeez. All right. This is supposed to be my own house.
That's a lovely house it is, and a lovely podcast studio.
You know what it is? Because you're so tall and intimidating. Even like when we're like... in relaxed settings, I always look at you like, man, JL, if I just say one wrong thing to him, he could snap me like a twig.
I had a legitimate comedian that I know and I'm friendly with, like somebody who's been on Letterman,
yeah,
basically write to me based on a comment I wrote on Facebook and said, is that really your bit? And then they said, and I was like, no, I'm fucking around. He or she was like, I'm serious. And I was like, no. And she goes, I don't want to make an enemy out of JL Colvin. I was like, is that one? Am I just some?
Because you have so many outlets that you use.
But it's like people. I'm not a tyrant. But anyway,
well,
sorry.
I mean, you say some crazy stuff sometimes that it's like, whoa, like on your podcast, Righteous Prick, right? And mm-hmm. I talked to you. I'm a big fan of your podcast.
Thank you.
And there's some things you say where I'm like, man, I really hope JL. I know he's probably joking, but I really hope he's not serious because I don't want to fight. I don't want to, like, next time I see him say, hey, you know, what you said was kind of crazy. And then you're like, oh, I'm going to break your face.
I'm not a violent man. I'm a man of peace.
Yeah.
This is in my movie trailer. You have me saying this, and then you show me, like, beating somebody to death in the other shot as I'm doing, like, a Michael Corleone baptism scene. On my podcast, I just expect at some point the FBI to knock on my door one day and be like, are you going to shoot up a comedy club? Like, no, I wouldn't waste the bullets.
Well, that's why it's good to have a law background, right? So you know, like, that you know what your legal parameters are.
I hope so. But let's be honest, wasn't a great lawyer.
Really?
I think...
When did you go to law school? Like, because that's the whole... we could talk about comedy, but, like, I'm really curious about your law background because I have friends that went to law school. Mm-hmm. Not everyone finished. Actually, 98% of them didn't finish for various reasons, either financial or they just realized in their second year, like, this is not for me.
Sure. I went, started in September of 2001 because I thought, you know, after 9/11, I had to serve my country somehow. And no, I was already obviously enrolled.
You took the LSAT, all that shit.
Yeah. And as I've said on stage, as a preface to a joke that I've recently done, I was going to law school in Washington, D.C., and I'm from New York. So obviously on 9/11, Al-Qaeda was really out to get me. They were trying to stop this comedy freight train from starting.
Oh, jeez.
I started in September 2001, graduated May 2004. The legal market was not terrific then.
Really?
It was the year after me, I think there was a real struggle. But the market was already sort of slowing down.
You went to Georgetown, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I had a job. I worked for the Bronx DA's office. I would have preferred private practice, but my grades were very mediocre in law school.
Now, how does that work? Like, I went to grad school, and grades I thought meant something, but yeah. They really ultimately didn't. So in law school, though, does it actually matter what you do? Like,
I think it does to a certain extent, especially when the market's not the greatest. It wasn't horrible yet, but it wasn't particularly good. And that's out of Georgetown. Obviously, there's lower rung law schools where there's a real struggle. But grades do matter. And unfortunately, I had a rough first year where I was just sort of adapting to the ways to study for law school. Like, I was working very hard, but not very smartly.
How is it different than like when you were in a normal 4-year college university?
I just felt like in college, I read the assignment and I'm done. And I just like, there's no shortcuts. You just do the work and you're done with the assignment. And then you write your paper, you do whatever. Yeah. With law school, I was like, I had a lot of friends everybody bought the outlines, which are like kind of summaries. They summarize all the main cases.
Okay.
And they're sold in the bookstore. They're not like cliff notes where teachers are like, you can't do that. But I was like, I'm going to read and I'm going to learn these cases in the original text. You know, I'm going to read the 1910 writing and I'm going to suck out all the lessons from it. Now, there are people who are super sharp who probably could do that easily and be like, yeah, I'm a 3.9 Georgetown because I fucking super, super smart. I'm smart enough to get into the club. As I said, intellectually, I'm like the chick that's just good looking enough to get in and then not get fucked in the club. So my grades were weakest at the beginning, which are sometimes the most critical because those will get you onto the summer associate track in with the firms.
And that's like what helps get you in the firm's eyes to be like, oh, okay, JL, potentially.
Because a lot of the time that's how they pick out their summer class leads. They usually want their summer class, which they nurture, develop, spend a lot of money on that first summer to be, you know, almost like as their preliminary training. So they come in right away. So they're people do it for sure or switch firms if they're excelling enough. But very few people kind of don't start at the firm level and then just like jump into a good firm at it. Like unless you've been, you know, with the firm already.
Now, did you know this when you like first started law school? If I get a summer.
I was literally counting them. I was like doing the money calculations of what I would make at 10 weeks at a big firm. I was like, man, I've never seen that much money. This is not lifeguarding money. I need to get some of this. And then after my first semester, I was like, I'm not getting that. I found law school, especially I found the first half of law school to be the most difficult experience of my life.
Wow.
I was in a long distance relationship with my college girlfriend. She was in med school in Ohio. And I think my first year, I didn't do that great, but I had a roommate who I'd gone to college with and played basketball with. So like, we didn't get along great as roommates. Can I tell you one? I'll tell you one story I did. He was more of the absent-minded slob, like a good dude.
Yeah.
And like, if you said something to him, he'd correct he'd do something.
Yeah.
But I was very passive aggressive. So like, he used all the spoons without washing them. Like, and that took like 3 to 4 days. Mm-hmm. Never washed a spoon. So he's watching TV like after classes and I'm eating cereal with a fucking ladle. And he goes, why aren't you using a spoon? I go, they're all in the sink. He goes, wash one. I go, I didn't use any of those spoons. Weird silence.
Yeah.
So he was like a messy dude, but he was a good dude. And of course I was used to, I had my own dorm room in college.
Yeah.
I had a room with my brother, but at 10, he went to college. Like when I was 11, he was already in college. So I had a very like my space, respect my space. I like my space. Like, so I was just where I should have just, I should have just said, dude, you got to watch some of these. Can you mind watching some of these? Instead I was a dick about it.
See, I feel like, that's because you have a big enough gap with your brother that you kind of like growing up in adolescence, you were kind of like an only child in a way. Right. I have the same thing. I'm the only child. So I don't mean to be like, seem like as a dick sometimes, but sometimes I'm like, yeah, I'm just used to having my own shit. So it's hard for me to like think about, tell you that it's bothering me, especially when you're living together. Like, so that along with school and then the long distance girlfriend,
it was
a shit show.
Yeah. But after first year, I was just like, man, I can't wait for this shit to be over. And then I stayed in DC that summer. Was that summer? No, I was back in the Bronx. I interned at the Bronx DA's office that summer, which is where I would eventually work out of law school. But
because originally from
Riverdale, which is part of the Bronx, yeah. And So second year was the worst. Was the first semester of second year of law school was like the most down time I've ever had in my life. I took all classes that I thought I should, that I had no interest in, but I was like, oh, I need a well-rounded.
First year, how does law school work with the 3 years? Because I know the third year is the one where you do the focus that you want to.
Yeah, you take. Right? I mean, second year you can kind of start taking whatever classes you want, but Okay. Obviously it's professional school. It's not. It's not like you're not a communications major, running back from University of Florida. You're still trying to gear yourself towards learning certain things. So yeah. I was like, all right, I'm gonna take corporations. I'm gonna take tax. I'm gonna take what else? Did I take criminal procedure and. I forget what other class, but
all those sound so boring except for criminal procedure.
I thought corporations, I actually didn't mind. I just didn't do that well in, but I actually found some of the stuff. That's the stuff I wish I'd retained more. And now I've just reading on my own books and what, like you start to learn a little bit more about it. But corporations, actually, I didn't hate. I just wasn't particularly good at it. And then I started getting very depressed. Tax, I skipped the last 13 classes of the year because I was like, fuck this shit.
Oh, shit.
My teacher was Ruth Bader Ginsburg's husband. The Supreme Court Justice, her husband is like a renowned tax professor, but it felt like he was teaching tax law to accountants. Mm. Like I was just like, you're going to have to slow this down. And then when it wasn't slowing down, I was like, I'm going to have to sleep in these next few months. But I was living on my own now. Me and my friend mutually sort of agreed. And I knew he didn't want to live with me, but we're still very good friends.
Yeah.
And I think that was a good move. That was why keep grinding this friendship away. Mm-hmm. Let's just be friends, and maybe we don't mesh together. And I'll take equal parts, if not more, of the blame for that. But now we're still good friends. So
yeah, some friends
good.
Just don't need to live together. Yeah.
And so I hope this isn't boring, but I was living on my own in a long distance relationship and really struggling with school, struggling to the point where I felt kind of helpless with it. So I was starting to drink a lot, and notice I'm not one of those pussies who's like, and then I got sober. No, I was just. I was just drinking a lot. And
you were away from family and shit, right?
I was close. I don't want to use that as an excuse. It was like mentally I was away. Like I was far away, but not, I mean, I was a 3-hour train ride from home. But I started sleeping in late. I started to have trouble like getting out of bed. Like I'd have class and I wasn't a class cutting dude.
Yeah.
Ever. And I just was like, I can't get, like, I don't want to get up. I don't want to get out of bed. I just want to stay here and, like, I'll maybe go for a run and then, like, show up to my afternoon classes. So my girlfriend at the time was, like, starting to pick up that I was very depressed. And so she was like, I think you should see somebody. I was like, I'm not seeing anybody. So she ended up calling a priest from Georgetown to go see me, like to come and like the
come to your apartment.
The doorman was like, "There's a Father English here," and I was like, "Who?" I was like, "Is there a mist of smog outside? Is this about to turn into some exorcist shit?" He was just this nice priest who then I started having like weekly lunches with and just talking about shit. And
are you a religious guy or?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it was just, she figured she wasn't Catholic, my college girlfriend, but she was like, he needs help. And
so if you're not going to see a psychiatrist,
I'll get him some form of help is better than none. And it was, and then that spring I had a complete turnaround in terms of my grades and I started going to comedy shows, not performing, but just
seeing them,
a couple of local bar shows. Yeah. Like a guy was handing out flyers who lived in my building at a bar show near my apartment, and it ended up being a couple of guys on the show. These names may not mean anything to people, but KT Tatara and Eric Myers, who are two guys, I think, both out in L.A., both doing, like, better than average.
Yeah.
But they're obviously at it, 14, 15 years.
Yeah.
But they were on the show, and I was just like, oh, that was fun. Like, it was just fun. This is, like, this is why I knew I would be, if I quit comedy, if I'd never done, I shouldn't say that, because if I quit comedy, I'm fucking burying that shit. I'm never walking into a comedy club again. But if I'd never done comedy, I can't. If I quit, I can't be around. It's like a.
But that's like you stopping like doing your YouTube videos and you stop watching movies. Like that just wouldn't happen.
I watch movies.
You wouldn't, you wouldn't watch like other mini videos or anything like that.
I mean,
you can't just like cut off an art. It's part of your life.
I'm not saying like laughter will die, but like I have no interest in stand-up comedy or seeing other people's successes or seeing like, because it will just anger me. Because I do feel, I know this is a beating a dead horse, but I do feel, I know everybody says there's no deserve, there's no this or that. I do feel like I've been unfairly treated by the industry and by my peers. For somebody that puts out very good product with very few resources and no backing whatsoever, I don't feel like I've gotten the credit I deserve or the respect I deserve. But anyway, back to more fun in law school. So,
but to be fair to you know, your career as it stands, you know, I do think that in New York comedy scene, like, people know who you are. They respect the work that you're doing. I think more now, like, based on, like, what I hear from your, you know, podcast and stuff like that, is that you're looking for the industry, like, to really recognize.
It's the only, there is no, this is anecdotal because I haven't studied every single comedian, obviously, but what I see is there's a few ways to move ahead right now. And you can be young and moldable and have a good look or a demographic.
I think they're steering away from that now.
Now they are. But there's also the, are you making money? Mm-hmm. Are you making money? Can we get a piece of that?
Yep.
Well, I'm in neither. I'm just good and hardworking, and people do know who I am. Like, I've worked with a lot of headliners on the road who'll say, oh, I worked with this guy. He said he knew you. He said he liked your videos. Like, I'm like, and I don't know these people who they're, you know, so it's like, my shit gets out there. Yeah. My shit is respected, like, in terms of, like, but me, I feel like I don't get the respect. It's like, okay. For whatever reason.
No, I do have to, like, because we'll get back to law school because I do want to follow up on wrapping that up and stuff. But I find this with me because I have a full-time job, and you're working full-time now, right?
Yeah.
And you started working full time recently, like about a year ago. Right? About 2 years ago, you started full time again. Because you had been part time and doing freelance for how long before that?
I was, just to give the brief timeline, I worked as a lawyer from 04 to 09.
Yeah.
09 or 08? Yeah, 09.
Okay.
Then in 09 to about 12, I had savings and I was just getting on the road and trying to make money.
Yeah, definitely talk
that.
About that.
And then in 2012, for about 2 years, I did part-time work in my mom's office, which is also sort of humiliating in its own way. But it was easy. I was looking for the easy way out. I didn't want to commit to something. I figured my mom is a safe place because I, at a moment's notice, I want to be able to
drop
bail.
It off. Yeah.
So I don't. It was more for that reason. And then I was just like, I'm broke. I'm actually in debt now. I need something more substantial and full time. So I got to doing doc review work, which is sort of the janitorial work of the legal field. But by you know, comparison to any hourly rate job, it pays pretty well.
Yeah.
It's flexible enough that I can take assignments when I want, as long as I see clear patches in my schedule.
Mm-hmm.
And if an assignment's long enough, hey, I need out Friday and Monday. Yeah. Is that cool? But it's exhausting.
My question for you is specifically, and I'm finding this now, I find that the people that are starting to break out are the people that, you know, to be fair to them, they didn't really have full-time jobs before now. But, like, I feel like the people that are breaking out now are the ones that just, all they do is comedy and writing and stuff. Like, they don't need to worry about, because they have, like, five roommates or whatever, they don't need to worry about financially supporting themselves the way you and I are kind of focusing on that. Do you feel like you, if you were to save money and allow yourself to have another full year of just solid comedy and writing, that could change things? Or are you just kind of like,
no,
it doesn't?
I honestly don't. And I thought about that because right now I'm working at probably 90% capacity as far as comedy production.
Okay.
I wouldn't be doing that much more. I'm just always exhausted. I use my weekends, my evenings. As I joked in a recent blog I wrote, I like the way my schedule is with working full time and not kind of stopping any of the comedy stuff I'm doing. It's like the best I have for my girlfriend is, you know, Netflix and pass out.
Yeah.
I'm just constantly tired when I'm not working. Like when I'm not, and it's like, that's what I miss. And it's like, I just want to relax at this point. Like I want.
And you would just do law.
I think so, and I don't like it. But now I turn 37 next week, and it's at this point now where I'm just sort of like, what do I want out of life?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, is it good enough? My girlfriend right now is just a super chill, supportive person that I like spending time with, and like, there's no fucked up agendas. There's no we really don't argue. We just get along, and it's like I value our time together, and I'm tired of just being like exhausted when I see her and just being like, yeah, rub my head, I want to go to sleep. Like, and I'm getting like tired, just like I'm literally like bringing myself into those moments. But comedy is very selfish at this point. Like, I firmly believe that I have TV talent, either in the writing or the performing department. That, yeah. I don't, people can hate or whatever. I have no doubt about that. None.
Yeah.
I have complete doubt of whether it's going to happen. And I'm not interested in squandering, you know, the rest of my quasi youth. Mm-hmm. I'm not young anymore. Yeah. But fighting for shit so I can be like 49 and single and like get a small piece of the pie and be able to say, okay, I'm a working comic now. Now I still have to struggle and be stressed, but my bills are paid with comedy. Because at this point, I don't think I still think if I were to hit, I'd hit big. But mm-hmm. if that doesn't happen, if I were to hit small, well then my life is just one big hustle.
Because you're just trying to like build from that.
Just constantly. Oh yeah, I'm headlining these 12 clubs. All right, I did well enough. I'll be back, and now I'm doing some cruise ships, and it's like my whole year is just some sort of fucked up. Okay.
You don't feel like you could just keep doing it though, because you have this backup plan. Like this law degree is a huge investment, right? Yeah. Law school costs a shitload of money,
yeah.
And you were able to be successful enough, I guess, as a Bronx assistant DA.
Yeah, and then I went to a private firm, which is really in that.
Is that where like you were able to accrue a lot of your savings and stuff?
I sold an engagement ring that was returned to me.
Yeah.
That year, and got full value for that, and that was a. That was a $20,000 ring that was actually like a $28,000 ring.
Mm-hmm.
So that money certainly helped having that back. And then I just saved some money because I was making a lot of money. And then I got laid off that year. There were a lot of layoffs, but I like to say I was the first.
At the private?
At the firm, yeah. 2009, which anytime I say that to anybody in the know, who either they're like, oh yeah, 2009 was a fucking bloodbath. Because you had 2007, 2008 was the financial crisis.
But this is the thing that blew my mind, right? Like, because I've heard that about lawyers and stuff like that, and that the climate's really
bankruptcy
bad.
Bankruptcy was the only thing that was going well.
Really?
Because there was no new business, that people were cutting costs or had no business to offer. So, and I was at like a mid-sized firm, but it was a really tough time because you just had no lawyer. There were no deals being made. People were cutting costs. The only thing, bankruptcy was like the only practice I think that was going well for obvious reasons.
Okay.
But yeah, I got laid off. I'm not going to lie. I was, and this has, I think, been the problem with starting a legal career when I was starting a comedy career, because they basically started at the same time.
Yeah.
Like I was 1 year into comedy when I graduated law school. My passion and my focus was always on comedy.
Mm-hmm.
I was never dumb enough to be like, I'm ready. I just did a big show at Caroline's. I only had to bring 12 people instead of 15. I think I'm ready. I think it was bad, unfortunately. I couldn't help it, but that they started at the same time because law was always the job, and I can't wait to get out of here, and when can I leave the office, and I got to get it. I never gave it a full focus, and maybe I wouldn't have liked it anyway, but I might have been better at it. In the DA's office, I was fine. It wasn't like I was like...
What were you doing there?
The investigations division, so that meant sort of, it used to be a more glamorous set of cases, I think, back in the old days, but it was like organized crime, guns, gambling, but a lot of that stuff was like outdated. Because there was no big organized crime in the Bronx, really. But you start with like low level shit, prostitution, gambling, things like that, illegal gambling.
Like, are you actually prosecuting these people, or
a lot of deal making. I think I want to say I had 6 trials before I left, but all 0 felonies. I second sat a murder trial, meaning just assisted the actual attorney, but all misdemeanor stuff.
And does that mean you got to go into court by yourself? You went with the district attorney? So you went in the court by yourself representing the Bronx and prosecuting people.
Yeah.
Like you were actual, that's dope.
Yeah. And
I think that's cool. One of my public speaking and shit.
I have, you know, half a dozen life regrets. And one of the top ones, which is sort of in conjunction with a personal life regret, in terms of getting engaged and then altering my life at that point. For what I thought was the better, but then probably was not, was leaving the DA's office because it was a good job. I mean, it didn't pay great, but good benefits, 5 weeks paid vacation, which when I thought about it, I was like, as a comedian, I could probably just make do with 5 weeks paid vacation. Like I do 4 weeks of road work and then like, you know, a vacation with my chick, whoever that might be, whatever hoe I was with at the time. No. And I could have built a career there or something that would have had value. And now my law degree is sort of worthless. The way my Ferguson credit is
because,
worthless.
But is it because like you've been out of the game so long?
Because I haven't, you know, I really thought when I got laid off in 2009, I had, you know, 3.5 years DA's experience, 1.5 year law firm experience. Yep. And I thought, I got money saved up. I just did Ferguson a year ago. I'm young. I'm still getting good road work. I got to go for it now. Yep. I went, like, took acting classes and shit, and I did nothing with it because I was just, I don't really know why. I just thought it would happen. Like, I thought if I worked hard at comedy, I didn't have to, I've never been good at, now I'm, like, aggressively bad at being a politician in comedy. It's almost like, I'm marketing myself better by being this anti-establishment than I would if I just did nothing.
I do think that that's...
But I'm not good at it, and I don't like it. I didn't, like,
Because you don't like to be that guy. You don't...
I hate politicians, not in politics, but everywhere else.
Yeah.
The work should stand for itself, mm-hmm. and my work is good, and I work hard, and that's sort of... I just feel like that should stand for itself, but, you know, I compared comedy. I said I got into comedy thinking it was tennis. Like, boom, it's me out there. If I fucking win the game, I win the game.
Yeah.
But this shit is like NASCAR or cycling.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, you may be Lance Armstrong, but you got 9 dudes in postal outfits, like, pumping you up and spreading the word and, like, help. That's either, those are your friends or those are other comics and that's your management team. Like, being great on your own is rarely enough. And I shouldn't say great because people think maybe you're not great. Being good, working hard and being good or being better than the average is not good enough. And I'm not good at, I don't like that other stuff. And at 37 now, almost 37, I just look at it and go, I feel too old and tired. I've put in everything I can to start, like, I probably can't undo whatever perception people have of me that don't know me.
Mm-hmm.
All I can do is keep making good work, but that's not leading to anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not that I want to be a lawyer. What I want is to enjoy my free time.
Mm-hmm.
And I like being on stage. I like doing all that shit. But it doesn't, the process no longer
excites you.
Excites me. It's like, what excites me, as weird as it sounds, is just, or maybe not weird, but like, oh good. I've like this coming weekend. It's my birthday weekend. I got Saturday and Sunday off. I don't want to do shit. I don't want to go out with some of my friends to drink. Cause we usually do that. Like for each other's, me and my best friend do that for each other's birthday. And I was just like, I'm trying to diet. I'm trying to like get lose some weight again. And I just don't want to. What I want is like I got 2 days to rest, to hang out with my dog and my girlfriend. And like Game of Thrones is on. I know I sound like an old dude, but I'm like, I've been working so hard and getting so little sleep. All I want to do is relax. And I think to myself like, yeah, why can't life be that way? Why can't I just have a regular job, which I have to have anyway? Like that's the thing. I'm not in that comedy world anymore where I'm like, yeah, you know, I'm hustling. I have to work a regular job. So if I have to work a regular job, what do I want to do with my spare time? Do 3 open mics with people who I'm not above doing open mics. I do them all the time.
Yeah.
But it's fucking at this point, it's like, it feels shitty. And to beg to be on some bar shows and then maybe I get some work. Maybe somebody tweets my video. Maybe, and then like, the weekend is spent like I gotta write this sketch or I gotta produce this sketch or I'm on the road and I'm just trying to keep my it's like I'm keeping my comedy career alive through artificial means.
Mm-hmm.
And what would I rather be doing? Keeping that until one day I just pull the plug anyway? And am I missing out on relaxing times, dates, just hanging out, doing like
now, do you think when you were younger, when you still like were like, you know, you were Bronx DA and you went to the private firm to get laid off, like, was there ever anything where you were like, I could potentially do that part-time still and keep some money? Or, you know, I know you say you wanted to go all in comedy, but at that point, like, because I imagine you were making so much money from the private firm, right? Because that's like the assumption like for we all have about lawyers and stuff, that you could have maybe balanced it out and you would still...
The truth is,
you would have been able to figure out that balance. So by now, you're like, yeah, it's just like routine for me. Like, I go to work.
The truth is, I could have done what I did now, for the last 2 years, and they were paying more. The Doc Review projects were paying more six, 7 years ago. You know, now they're paying like $32 an hour. They're paying like $45 an hour, $40, $45 an hour back
now,
then.
How do you get back to doing the trial stuff? Or is that even something you want to do?
The truth is, if I go back to that, where I would want to go is the Cuyahoga County prosecutor, the Cleveland DA, basically.
Okay.
Because I really like Cleveland, and I feel like I'm priced out of New York now. Mm-hmm. Like,
it's fucking being practical, crazy.
It's just, that's the other thing. Like, from a mental standpoint, mm-hmm. I just described it. From a financial standpoint, it's like, I took my girlfriend to Cleveland for, like, I had 4 days of gigs.
Yeah.
And I like Cleveland, so she was cool, and we went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But it was like, I was like, I'm already going to be here, and instead of treating this like a comedy trip where I'm losing money, this is going to be like a little vacation where I get paid, our hotel's paid for by the Cleveland Improv.
Yeah.
And that was fine, but even at the end of that, I was like, man, she likes the beach. She's not a demanding chick, and I've fucked up relationships with women like this before.
Yeah.
Where the good ones don't demand anything, and it makes it more painful when you can't give them something.
Mm-hmm.
When you're just like, oh, yeah, no, it's I don't need that. I don't need that. And you're like, I know. That's why I want to give it to you. That's why I want you to, like, you know, have some nice things. I'm not talking about jewelry. I'm just saying, like, yeah, I'd like to take you on a trip or get you nice stuff, like, and not feel like I'm fucking stressed over, like, paying for mm-hmm. shit. But the other thing, like, living in Cleveland would be so much cheaper.
Yeah.
Do
you have to take a different? You have to take a different bar.
I think I'd have to pass the Ohio bar. Yeah.
You think that's going to be difficult? Like, so for law school and shit, you had to do the LSAT to get into law school,
mm-hmm.
and you had to do pretty well to get into Georgetown.
Yeah.
Right. And then from there, you become a lawyer. Well, no, you graduate law school. Then you take the bar. Right.
Take the bar. That's right.
And that's like, how long a test is that now?
What the fuck? I don't know. It's a work. It's like close to a work day.
It's a whole day.
And I failed it the first time I took it.
Really?
Yeah, I failed it by 3 points, and I left an essay blank, which I should have just written something. I think I would have gotten the 3 points, but I didn't.
You just ran out of time?
No, I didn't know anything I had on that topic because I had completely fucked up my studying for that, which was emblematic of me in my first year of law school. I was just like, I just went to movies and the gym the first month. I went to the classes, and then I was like, I'll start studying in July. But you really need to, like, you need to treat it like a 2-month job, because your job is not to get an A.
Mm-hmm.
Your job is to get a D. They don't grade it like that, but, like, this, it's pass fail. So, like, you pass by 1 point, you get the exact same thing as the dude who, you know, set the all-time high score.
Got it.
There's no pass plus. Yeah. There's just pass.
They don't look into your actual score, though, if you apply for private firms and everything like that?
No.
They just want to know you passed.
That's it. You're barred. There's nothing.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, and I failed by 3 points, and I laughed because I was like, I'm going to have to take two months off of work to pass this shit, and I know I will. Like, I was as relaxed as I've ever been with anything in law, taking it again, because I was like, give me a fucking break. I ate a dick on this thing, and I was two multiple choice questions away from passing, even leaving the fucking essay blank.
Yeah.
And then I passed, and I was like, not stressed. Like, I was just like, I'm gonna pass this shit. But I started studying for the full 2 months. Like, I didn't go, yeah, I'll go to the class. And then it was easy because you just needed to know enough. And I left going, I did much better than the first time, so I'm gonna pass. And when I got it, I was like, of course I passed.
So you graduate law school, like, you get the degree, but that doesn't mean anything if you don't pass the bar, pretty much.
Right. I mean, you can get a job somewhere, like, you just can't practice law. Like, you might be like, oh, he's got a legal background, he's learned. Like, if
so you could
job
be like
is,
a paralegal or something like that?
No, I'm just saying if you had a job either in business or something where they're like, oh, it's a plus that he's, like, got this this schooling.
Yeah.
But he doesn't need to. But yeah, I don't know why you'd obviously take it and not pass, take the bar.
Got it. So if you were to go back to the courtroom, you would do that back in Cleveland?
Yeah, I think so. Because there
in New York, it just
well. Here's
just
here's I just point of comparison. A starting DA in the Bronx as of 2014, the salary I think was 57 to start.
Oh shit!
In Cleveland, it was 50. The cost of living,
mm-hmm.
anecdotally, is like 65%.
Yes,
of New York. So you're really it would be more like the Bronx DA or whoever offering you $78,000 or something, or $75,000. Now you're going, that's not so bad.
And what kind of hours are you logging each week as an assistant DA?
It was 9 to 5 unless you had something. Like if you were working on a trial or prepping or helping somebody prep for something, then you'd have to put in longer hours. But it was 9 to 5 80% of the time.
And it's salaried? Or salaried. would you think, so if you had to work a longer hours for a big case, like you wouldn't get OT or anything like that? Wait, so you're telling me, like, I don't know how it works in California, but, like, the O.J. Simpson trial, when they were doing all those long hours, they weren't getting paid extra?
Most likely not. I can't speak to that. But also, those were senior people who are probably making $100,000, which isn't great when you're working that much. But, like, the senior people at the DA's office are, you know, your salary goes up, obviously.
Did you watch that show?
I loved it.
What did you think from a law standpoint?
I mean, some of the stuff was surprising, but I've never been involved directly in something like that high profile. Mm-hmm. I've never tried a celebrity murder case.
I wasn't part of the trial of the century.
Right. But I just found it interesting, and it, you know, kind of reminded me of a lot of shit, but obviously it was more sensational than the average trial. Also, like, you throw Johnny Cochran in there, it's like, it has a different dynamic. Yeah.
What was your dynamic like in the courtroom?
A little nervous, which is weird. But the thing is, to me, comedy is meaningless, whereas the law is not. Yeah. So, and because I could get on stage 5 nights, 6 nights a week, so you get comfort with it. Even if you're, there's a new show or a new club. Yeah. I'm a little nervous. I got butterflies. But the DA's office, that's real. Like, it's not just real like my job. It's like real people. Mm-hmm. There's either a victim and there's a defendant. There's jury. There's and I always found myself very nervous before most of my trials. And I think I would have gotten better at it because I do have obviously good sort of presentation skills. Mm-hmm. But I never felt super comfortable.
Interesting.
Because it was. There is pressure. Like, that's the thing.
Yeah.
You can say, hey, there's no pressure. It's like, no, this isn't even like a classroom. This is not theory. This is not a debate at a school. This is like, now it's real people and real crimes, even if they're small. Like, this has consequences and, you know,
people go to jail. And
right. And, yeah, I just always found myself, not like sweating or cotton mouth, but just like anxious.
Did you ever have experiences where, like, you were like, I really wish I didn't have to prosecute this person? Or, like, you know, like, the judge ruled in favor of you, and, like, someone went to jail for, like, a long time, and you're just like,
right,
God damn it.
No, I never had anything like that because, you know, fortunately, I didn't stay long enough to get really heavy, heavy shit yet. Yeah. But I remember one case, it was very low level, it was like a misdemeanor or something. And my boss wouldn't give a plea deal because he wanted to know, hey, where'd you get the fake license plate? Like, or whatever it was. It was something like a fake license plate or a fake sticker. Where'd you get it? He always wanted things like, hey, if somebody's manufacturing this shit, like, tell me where you got it, we'll give you the plea.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, there's no plea. The defense lawyer would just be like, I won't, you know, he wants the, you know, whatever disposition of the case, just something lighter than what we were offering. My boss would always be like, no. And sometimes I'd be like, I don't think we have that strong a case, and I don't think it's worth giving this dude a criminal record, even if we did. But you did what the boss said. But the thing is, you do what the boss says, because this isn't one of these things where he's like, you know, we have tainted evidence, and he's saying, you know, this is just his position on the case. Like, we have a case. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like, dude, I think this other dude did it. You know, it wasn't a making a murder shit where it's we have other suspects. Fuck that.
Do you think... That was the craziest thing about the OJ show, man. It's when David Schwimmer, that poor guy, just saying juice. When he was like, who else could it be?
OJ didn't do it.
Juice. Come on, Juice.
I feel bad for Robert Kardashian so much in that movie because all you're like, okay, so the last years of your life, you've basically figured out your best friend's a fucking homicidal maniac. And you die, fortunately. Not to see your daughter chugging dick on camera and becoming a mogul from that. Like there's a phrase, the fruit of the poisonous tree in criminal law, which is basically an old case. I think it was, what was it, Wong Su? I forget. I think I have the one name of the part of the case. But it was in criminal procedure where that's, you know, why cops have to exclude. It's like a punishment. Like if a cop finds evidence, but they use unconstitutional means, even if it's like the fucking bloody glove, but you bust into his house without a warrant, the bloody glove goes away. It's suppressed because you didn't. It's almost you know, in your mind, you're like, but look, it's the glove. It's like, yeah, but you violated his rights before you knew there was a bloody glove. So we have to exclude that evidence. Because
the law is so fucking technical.
Because it's fruit of the poisonous tree. And there's exceptions and things like that. But like, in other words, why was I making that comparison?
Because we're talking about the OJ and Rob Kardashian.
Oh, thing. Yeah. It's like, and his daughter, it's like he didn't have to see, like, their entire line of success stems from her sucking dick on camera. It's like, what kind of, what father wants to see that?
Yeah. He already had it rough. He had the hairline and everything. It was bad. You mentioned Making a Murderer, right? What did you think of that from a law standpoint?
Based on obviously what I could see, I thought it was fascinating. I thought the defense lawyers, I'm not even kidding, made me want to become a lawyer again, like become a real fucking full-time lawyer. Because I was just like, man, if I could dedicate myself to the law the way I dedicate myself to comedy, maybe I could have been doing good like this being good at it and doing good with it. Those were the guys who stood out to me because I just thought they were like, they were like nerdy rock stars because they were just so good at what they were doing.
And like poking the holes in like...
And legitimate hole. It wasn't, no offense to the memory of Johnny Cochran, but it wasn't let's cloud them with doubt. It was like, no, there's real issues that we're exploring here, not just kind of creating an environment where you can find doubt. And obviously, biased or not, the prosecutor looked like a real, generally a piece of shit.
Yeah, that's like the one thing that didn't sit well with me. Like, I know it's the biased production and everything, but like, I personally do think that Stephen Avery did some shady shit in the second one. But the prosecutor, with the fact that like it came out that he was so like unethical and had all these weird things, like I'm surprised the case didn't get thrown out because of that. Like, or and at the doesn't same, that happen to the prosecutors?
Rarely. Well, the problem is the prosecutor has the judgment to throw the case out. That's what a prosecutor is really supposed to be. Everybody thinks like prosecutors are handed cases and it's like go attack dog, but they're actually the ones who are supposed to. The DA is the one who's supposed to kind of make the final decision on whether you prosecute or not. Now, that authority is delegated to like deputies and things like that, like bureau chiefs. But like in a high profile case, you've got to look at it and say, should we go forward or should we be exploring other things? Obviously, the prosecutor in that case is portrayed poorly, but obviously he thinks he's going after a murder. And I think one theory is obviously the guy did it, but they used they did shady shit to make sure they got him. But as was shown, he didn't do the first one. And my thing is, if the evidence were better, if there weren't so many questions, I think one way to approach this obviously would be maybe a mental illness kind of approach, like, hey, this guy's a fucking almost retarded and spent 18 years in jail that he shouldn't have. Yeah. As we're sorry for this, and maybe he's guilty, you know, not guilty by reason of insanity or some shit. Like,
yeah,
some,
they proved that he had a really low IQ, right, or something like that.
Yeah,
the whole family is just.
But they were going obviously for the full innocence plea, not. But it was all very disturbing, and it just goes to show you that you know, money is the best thing you can have in this justice system. Unfortunately, I think. It goes money first, closely followed by be white. But money trumps money. Poor, when it comes to the justice system, I think Chris Rock kind of made this joke, obviously a long time ago, about OJ. It's not about race, it's about fame.
Yep.
I think when it comes to the justice system, I think when it comes to police and interactions on that level, I think race plays a bigger factor than obviously plays a bigger factor than economics because you could be black behind a BMW and be fucking pulled over because they'll think you're a drug dealer. But when it comes to the system, like the law, legal system, money trumps everything.
Well, I do. That's a great segue because I actually read the new Jim Crow book.
Yeah,
because you recommended on your podcast and you had a law background. I'm like, I need a nonfiction book to read this month. Let me check this out. And that book is so good. I bought it for my best friend who lives down in Kissimmee. Because he's always been interested in law. And I'm like, you got to read this book because it'll make as a black man, it'll make you furious. But at the same time, you feel like you're educated on why the system is so bad and detrimental to our country. And no one's talking about it.
Oh, it was that book was tremendous. Like, I just feel like that's one of those books where you're like, why aren't... And we need more non-like-minded people reading this because it's so clinical. Yep. It's so case law and statistic driven, that book. She just gives it narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But I think she knows it's such a hot button topic. It's so sensitive that she just makes it the facts. Like, yep. Because she wants it to be obviously kind of unassailable. Like, you have to read this and go, I guess I was wrong. Like, it's not exactly. Somebody, it's not somebody writing a blog on how they feel about the stuff. It's like, here are the stats, here's the history,
here's the case law
as it goes. It's really, really very strong, that book.
How do we get more people, because you said we're like-minded, how do we get people that are not like that to read this shit? Because I've tried to, like, so my conservative friends, wait, dude, you need to read the new Jim Crow. And they're like, yeah, no, I'm not going to do that.
Right.
And like, just fucking educate yourself. Like,
I feel like our pop culture now is driven by, or serious pop culture, I should say, not like music and stuff, but like serious, because news is now part of pop culture. Yep. I think it's driven by, and I don't want to sound like some shitty politician who doesn't mean this, like, we need to come together instead of going through things that divide us, because half the people who say that are like fucking driving wedges between people.
Yeah.
I think there's too much the mentality now from your Facebook feed to like I deleted two conservative dudes mm-hmm. because I was tired, but like it was outrageous stuff. It wasn't like, I have plenty of friends in law school that I don't delete that are on the conservative side. I just disagree with them. But these are guys who are like posting memes of like the ambassador in Libya, like having something probed up his ass, like a charred body with something being probed up his ass.
Oh,
like, this is what Hillary Clinton doesn't think matters. And then somebody wrote under it. It's like, this meme has been debunked like months ago. What are you doing? You're better than this.
Yeah.
And that's when I was like, okay, you're just somebody who indiscriminately wants to like shit on who you don't like, but mm-hmm. you're not a valuable voice. You're not a voice that needs to be listened to. Maybe in the statistical sense, we should know that you're out there like the Trump voters, but your opinion doesn't matter that much. And that's my thing with Trump versus Sanders, as much as I shit on Sanders fans.
Yeah, you've been going hard at them lately.
Well, because they're annoying me.
What is with them? What do you think of their campaign constantly citing legal issues with like how the campaign, like about the primary elections? Like they're doing like the new. Well, no, aren't they doing something with New York now? Because
well,
no,
they've
primaries?
Got now. They've all of a sudden, because their boy didn't do it well. They've got like a moral qualm with primaries, closed primaries. They're not democratic. Well, it's the Democratic Party, motherfucker. How about this? If you want to start a revolution, start by forming a political party, because I can guarantee you that's easier than upending the entire system of the U.S. government and economy. Yeah. So form a third party. Fine, do it. I won't like it because it might hurt the Democrats, but that's what you do. It's the Democratic Party. They have well-established rules. But, oh, you just got involved 5 months ago because you fucking fell in love with your 74-year-old Jewish rock star.
Yeah.
So that's what you want to be about, that movement. Well, guess what? The people who get first dibs are the people who didn't give up or become cynical or become fucking armchair independents who know little but act like they're morally or intellectually superior because they stay out of it because it doesn't mean anything, man.
Yeah.
Fuck you. You lose because you didn't want to play the rules of the game.
Yeah.
They were clearly laid out. This isn't like a voter suppression thing like, oh, Obama won, ID laws. Like, that's what the Republicans did. It was like, Obama won and a lot of people came out. We need to shut that shit down. That's wrong. These rules were not in place to help Hillary Clinton or to hurt Bernie Sanders. Yeah. The rules are the rules. This dude wasn't even a member of the Democratic Party. And these are only things I'm saying to rebut. I'm fine with his candidacy. I like what he's bringing to the table in terms of the issues.
Mm-hmm.
It's this whole, I'm a revolutionary. Oh, no, now I'm a victim. Now I'm a martyr.
Yeah.
And I'll play whatever role my fans will get my fans most riled up. And that's the shit that I don't like.
All right, Chief Keef.
Huh?
Chief Keef, you never heard that song?
No.
All right.
What I'm sorry, I'm a little sleepy.
He's like, that's that shit I don't like. He's a Chicago rapper. He got evicted from his apartment. It's crazy. Right.
Cool. But I don't know what got me going on that rant, but I I've been going at them. Oh, but well, the Trump versus Sanders. Here's what I'll say about the Trump. They both speak to, like, in many ways, working class whites.
Mm-hmm.
But this is what's so funny in terms of respecting someone's viewpoint. If you are working class white who's either been Republican or whatever, and now you think the Republican Party's full of shit or not addressing it, and you go to Bernie Sanders, I go, good for you, because you are responding to your needs in an appropriate way. You're going to the candidate that you think will address your needs in a helpful, proactive, positive way. But if you hate the Republican Party for the same reasons and you go to Trump, that's because your thinking, whether subconscious or not, is, well, I don't like the Republican Party, but I'm not ready to get down with gays and blacks yet.
Mm.
So Trump's my man. Immigrants, I don't really like immigrants.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to like, so if I have to pick the positive progressive, the positive populist or the demonizing populist, I think that tells you, me everything I need to know about you.
Yeah.
You either, you go to, and you don't have to want to go to Hillary. I get that. She's got problems. She's got weaknesses. She has things you don't have
she's
to like.
She's got a lot of problems.
But when it comes to choosing between like, if you're leaving the parties or like the mainstream candidates and your choice is Trump, I don't need to listen to your fucking viewpoint.
Oh, absolutely not.
So like, and whereas Bernie, I'm not going to unfriend you because you like Bernie or you're talking shit or you're passionate about Bernie. Yeah. I'll disagree. I may make jokes, but I'm not. That's fine. Yeah. But if your reason is like, I don't like what the Republican Party's doing, so I'm going to the guy who demonizes others. Like,
I got to say, though, if Trump, God forbid, I shouldn't even say this out in the universe, but if he ever were to be elected, there's going to be a lot of work for you in the law department.
Yeah.
Because he's going to be suing the shit out of everybody.
Yeah. And in the impressions department.
But, JL, thank you so much for doing this, man. I know you got an album recorded.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah, man. You had a time limit.
Oh, I feel like I fucked up the episode.
No, man, it was great. This is great. I got to learn about law school and all that stuff, man. That's what this whole thing is about. It's just me learning. I'm trying to expand my horizons.
Sure. Well, law school's tough. don't be in a long distance relationship in law school. It may break you.
It's never been the same.
Yeah. No, there have been certain experiences in my life I can chart them that are just like, they just made me a darker person.
That's what I'm
just
like.
Happy, dark,
that's what created
darker.
The Joker. You're just like, oh, okay.
Yeah. I think sometimes I look at my life and I go, it does feel like the origin story for a supervillain.
See, I don't like, that happened to me the other day. I said, I had a Facebook status about, I only had like a 2 hours of sleep because I flew in from Vegas and like there's a time change. I'm all
bumpy flight, I heard.
Yes, yes. And everyone started calling me Bane. Like, you sound like Bane.
And I was
like, fuck you guys. But you got an album recording coming up, so please tell people about that because a lot of
New York people. Yeah, the links aren't ready yet, but I've been confirmed from the Standing Room in Long Island City. I'll be doing 2 shows on June 24th for my next album, which is going to be Real Hot Fire, as the kids say, if they're still saying that. It's going to be lit.
Yeah, they're not saying any of those.
Not saying lit anymore?
Yeah, they're... No, because...
It's lit. Can I just say it's lit?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. yeah, no, so that's... I mean, I don't have much else. I have gigs in North Carolina in August because I don't give a fuck about bathrooms when it comes to getting feature work. Like... My $250 at the fucking Days Inn and the five Franklins I'll be getting, or the, what should I say, the 25 Tubmans I'll be getting.
Oh, at, boy. That lit Facebook on fire today.
Oh, I was dropping some good ones. Although I did like that I was able to get to the stripper one quick because that was where everybody was going with the 20.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the CD, if anybody's interested, it will be a good show. Chris Lamberth will be opening for me. So yeah, I'd like to say I'm excited about that, but I view it more as
your swan song.
A little bit. Like it's like because I just want a bookend. Like I wanna I have a lot of material. My last two albums, which were my two best, I did one in 2012 and then I did one like 17 months later, because I just had that much. I had that much of a writing spurt, and then that's the funny thing is that the next one people thought was my best one. So it wasn't like I was just like I'm pumping out content for the fuck of it. Like people thought last two were my best, and that my last one was better than the second to last one. So I feel good about this because it's been three. It'll be almost 3 years since I did one, and you know I've got the material now. I'm like figuring out how to piece it together to make it into a kind of coherent product, but should be good. And that's the other thing that nobody. I said this to a friend. And I'm sorry to keep you, but I said to a friend of mine, I was like, three of my four albums are one take, and only one of them I did a second show, and I just used 3 tracks out of like 20 from one show, like a chunk of 12 minutes, and put it into and that was it. And I laugh because these are coming off of weeks where I'm like featuring, or maybe I did some spots, and I laugh. I'm like, if you think these are fucking good. Just imagine, and this is like one of those tantalizing things that makes me keep wanting to go if I ever get my break. Imagine I had just been headlining B and C rooms for 3 months before and then could do 3 or 4 shows of a CD. I'm proud of the albums, but like yep. if I had the opportunities, they'd be instead of A minuses or A's in my book, they'd be A plus pluses. And I know it sounds the facts are the Absolutely. Facts. Like these are one take. You know, fucking Jay-Z of comedy here, except better. except I'm not falling off. All right.
They can listen to these albums on Spotify and Pandora, right. right?
Yeah, yeah. All four are up there. So yeah. So check them out, and if. You know, if you dig them, then you can be at the recording of the next one.
And check out your podcast, Righteous Prick.
Yep, iTunes, Stitcher, or just go to jlcomedy.com. Click on, you know, all the links for the movie reviews, the sketch videos, calendar, podcast. It's all there.
You can see yours truly in a few of these videos, guys, bringing the old man wisdom.
Fucking Thundercrack Malcolm.
Oh, that's my favorite role today. And I've done, like, some crazy shit for, like, MTV and stuff. That's my favorite role.
Well, thank you for nailing it.
I gotta say.
You captured exactly the spirit I wanted.
Thank you so much, Joe, for coming through, man.
Thank you. I am not throwing away my shot. Yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. I'ma get a scholarship to King's College. I probably shouldn't brag, but dag, I'm amazed and astonished. The problem is I got a lot of brains, but no polish. I gotta holler just to be heard with every word. I drop knowledge. I'm a diamond in the rough. A shining piece of coal, trying to reach my goal. My power of speech, unimpeachable. Only 19, but my mind is older. These New York City streets get colder. I shoulder every burden, every disadvantage I've learned to manage. I don't have a gun to brandish. I walk these streets famished. The plan is to fan this spark into a flame. But damn, it's getting dark, so let me spell out the name.